You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.
Hi, everyone. This is John Mandrola from theheart.org Medscape Cardiology, and this is This Week in Cardiology for September 29th, 2017. This week, I'm talking oxygen in stroke, PFO closure, physical activity, hospital ranking systems, and MRI conditional cardiac devices. First up is oxygen. It's been a bad couple of months for oxygen. 2 months ago at the ESC, we learned routine oxygen offered no benefit in patients with suspected acute MI. Now, another RCT, randomized controlled trial, this one from UK authors, has found the use of low-dose oxygen supplement did not reduce death or disability at 3 months in patients with acute stroke who were not hypoxic. JAMA published this RCT of more than 8,000 patients. Not even one subgroup could be found that benefited from oxygen. Now, this sort of study, along with the oxygen and MI study, should be celebrated. First, these are strong RCTs, and we need more RCTs. This podcast celebrates the RCT. Second, these studies beautifully demonstrate that things we all thought were beneficial, supplemental oxygen of all things, provides no benefit. Knowing this negative trial allows us to save money on oxygen. More important, though, than the dollar savings is the savings from distraction, meaning the energy we spend doing non-beneficial things can be directed at things that have more utility. And one thing you'll learn from our news story is that another RCT looking at high-dose oxygen therapy in patients with very early stroke is being tested. And that sounds like a good idea, right? High-dose oxygen, maybe it's improving brain function or saving brain function, but I'm glad it's being studied. Now, next topic is PFO closure. A couple of weeks ago, I promised to study and learn more about the PFO closure trials. And I did that, and I did learn a lot. And here's the short summary. The New England Journal published 3 RCTs, 2 new ones, and one was long-term follow-up of a previously published study, and all 3 of these favored PFO closure over medical therapy, which mostly included antiplatelet drug. Now, this is a medical reversal of sorts. 3 earlier trials on PFO closure versus medical therapy were negative. Except maybe one of these earlier trials trended in the PFO direction, but it did not reach statistical significance in the intention to treat analysis. So what's the difference between these 3 negative and 3 positive trials? So I believe, after looking at this, that it was probably patient selection and the choice of endpoints. For instance, the 3 previous trials of PFO closure versus medical therapy included TIAs, and TIAs are really soft and very subjective. So I think that's a fatal flaw. Also, at least one of the older trials allowed patients with lacunar strokes. And this less careful selection biases the trial towards medical therapy because PFO closure cannot help patients with stroke due to vascular diseases. PFO closure can only help patients who have PFO as the cause of their stroke. Now, the 3 most recent PFO trials were very careful to select patients who were likely to have had strokes caused by the PFO. They did not include TIAs, and they only used confirmed strokes in the endpoints. The caveats of these positive trials are that PFO showed superiority to aspirin and antiplatelets, but that's a problem because aspirin antiplatelets is really a lousy therapy for venous thrombosis. Nobody uses aspirin to treat venous thrombosis. The real comparison needs to be against anticoagulation, and in 2017, I would say that direct-acting oral anticoagulants. Now, I'm not sure this trial is going to be done, but this is the real question, is whether PFO closure with a device and a foreign body in the heart would be better than long-term direct-acting oral anticoagulants. So some other caveats that should be discussed at the bedside include the fact that event rates were very low. The absolute differences between the medical therapy and the PFO group was quite small, And also, you have to remember that the procedure starts with a 2 to 6% risk of serious complications, as it's an invasive procedure. Finally, some keys to discuss at the bedside. It's a must to exclude all other causes of stroke in these patients. You have to exclude vascular disease, hypercoagulable conditions such as factor V Leiden, and also a search for AF. And on Twitter, there was a discussion about how much searching for AF is needed. And then you have to confirm a PFO and grade it. The bigger the PFO, the more likely it is to be causative. You know, in my column that I wrote on this, Dr. David Spence, an expert in stroke, may note that taking a history may shed light on the possibility of a paradoxical embolism. For instance, things such as stroke associated with prolonged sitting or Valsalva maneuver really suggest that the stroke could have been from paradoxical embolism. Spence also suggested that cardiologists consider the use of the transcranial Doppler, as it may be more useful than TEE for confirming large right-to-left shunts. Next topic, physical activity. Here we go again. You can learn a lot from studying 130,000 or more people, especially when these people come from all over the globe, not just wealthy countries like the U.S. The latest report is from the Pure Study investigators, and it found strong evidence, and sit down for this, get ready, higher recreational and non-recreational physical activity associated with a lower risk of mortality and CV events. Physical activity ranging from low, moderate to high was associated in a graded way with reductions in mortality. Now, the authors discuss the population attributable risk, the PAR. The PAR estimates the risk if that factor were removed. So the population attributable risk of not making the physical activity guidelines was 8% for mortality. So just to put that in context, the estimated PAR, population attributable risk for smoking, is estimated to be at 12 to 14%, and for high lipids of 9%. So the point here is that being sedentary is quite high risk in the level of smoking and high lipids. Physical activity being important isn't really big news, but it does represent an important area of intervention. Benefits of physical activity in this study began at 30 minutes per day, and interestingly, the authors found no evidence of reduced benefits at high levels of exercise. So I like to tell patients that walking or other forms of regular exercise is like a heart pill, only you don't swallow it, and it's best to take this heart therapy every day. Next topic is measuring hospital quality. So the authorities in the U.S., CMS, uses data for Medicare fee-for-service beneficiaries aged 65 or older to calculate a 30-day mortality rate. Now they do it risk-adjusted, but 30-day mortality rate risk-adjusted. And they use these numbers to generate a hospital quality ranking score. It's publicly reported. Sounds good, right? Well, a large group of researchers led by a team at Yale found that these outcomes in elderly patients may not reflect the outcomes for younger patients with MI. Their analysis included well more than 500,000 hospital encounters over a four-year period from 2010 to 2014. The Annals of Internal Medicine published this study. Adding robustness to the findings was the fact that the authors used data from the health records rather than administrative claims. Now, most top and bottom performing hospitals for older patients were neither top nor bottom performers for younger patients. So I want to repeat that. The good hospitals for older patients may not have been the good hospitals for younger patients. Also, achievement scores for older patients correlated weakly with those for younger patients. The R value is only 0.30. In the editorial, the head of the Joint Commission said, quote, "We should not assume that the ranking reflects the hospital's true quality of care compared with its peers because of potentially inadequate adjustment for case mix differences." Now that's the head of the Joint Commission talking. I've probably said this before, but one of my old teachers at Indiana, Harvey Feigenbaum, used to holler at us when we tried to call things on an echo we could not see. He would say, if you can't see it, don't call it. It's better not to have data than have bad data. Now, I'm not against healthcare quality. I'm for healthcare quality. But putting too much time and effort in collecting this data And then basing reimbursement on flawed data is extremely unwise. Not only is it unfair and inaccurate, but it also creates unintended consequences. For instance, and I've written about this before, one of the consequences of these quality measures is giving high-dose statins to non-ambulatory, demented, frail, 90-year-old elders who just had a stroke. That is ridiculous. The last topic today, speaking of ridiculous, is MRI labeling. Another line of cardiac devices has earned FDA labeling as MRI conditional. The latest report is that a number of devices from Boston Scientific are now going to be MR conditional. Now, Medtronic, St. Jude, and Boston have MR conditional devices. I think the real story with this MR labeling issue is that essentially all patients with cardiac devices can be safely scanned, whether they have labeling or not. Now, I did the evidence review for the recent HRS consensus document, and I found numerous studies confirm the safety of scanning legacy devices, even devices with cutoff leads. Now, institutions need to have a protocol, they need adequate supervision from a knowledgeable EP, they need collaboration with the MRI division, and of course, the thing that an institution needs most is the desire to help patients. It's quite sad that over the past decade or so, we've denied patients access to MR scanning for no real reason other than billing and or our attachments to dogma. So that's it for this week in cardiology. I'm grateful that you listened. Please feel free to leave comments. I appreciate your comments, and I'll see you next week. This is John Mandrola from the Heart.org Medscape Cardiology.
You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from the Heart.org on Medscape.